too long, there have been those in the center, the people who set the standard, make the decisions, and hold the power, and the people relegated to the margins, those less seen, less heard, less understood, and less valued. It doesn't have to be that way. The truth is, our world will always be better when we bring more and more of our community to the forefront of our partnerships, of our kinship, and our service. So how do we make sure we don't lose sight of the humanity that's centered in the margins and too often lost in our policy conversations, our decisions, and our actions? That's the question for today's public health professionals and for you, public health leaders to come. The answer? We tell better stories. We amplify the voices of those less seen and less heard. Because when more are seen, heard, understood, and respected, the world is so much better. This is what this podcast aims to do. Welcome to Less Seen, Less Heard, Stories from the Margins. Welcome everyone to Less Seen, Less Heard. My name is Craig Andrade. I'm the Associate Dean of Practice, Director of the Activist Lab at BU School of Public Health. And today we have Sashi James from Family for Justice is Healing, Building Up People, Not Prisons. I'm grateful to have you join us, Sashi. You want to introduce yourself to the audience?
Hi, everybody. I'm Sashi James. I'm with Families for Justice is Healing, Building Up People, Not Prisons, and the National Council for Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. I'm based in Roxbury, and I'm a daughter of formerly incarcerated parents, and I'm excited to be on this podcast.
Could you tell the audience a little bit about who you are and what brought you to the work of this organization?
Sure. So I'll just give a brief history of Families for Justice as Healing. Families for Justice as Healing is an organization that was founded inside of Danbury. There was about five women at the table. One of those women was my mom. But at the table, there was about 100 years of incarceration. And there was also an uptick about ending mass incarceration. However, nobody was talking about women. Women were not at the center of that conversation, or the front or the behind. And my mom, being a former attorney, also an alumna of Northeastern, she hit the ground running with a mission to end incarceration of women and girls. Most of those five women that were at the table are now home. Sister Virginia, Justine Moore, Shay Smith, one of my favorites, which is our matriarch, which is grandma, who is Felix Hardy. Before I move forward with why I'm here, I always like to talk about grandma came home, she was actually wheeled out on an oxygen tank. And now she's just leading and running every rally in North Carolina. She is at the forefront. She is the voice of formerly incarcerated and incarcerated women, which is a prime example of how harmful prisons are and how they really deteriorate women while they're incarcerated, because she no longer needs an oxygen tank or a wheelchair. The reason why I'm here is because I'm a daughter of formerly incarcerated parents. My dad served a chunk of time. I always make jokes, but when I was a child, I never knew what Father's Day was because I didn't have a relationship with my father because he was incarcerated for many years. And then my mom served 24 months inside of Danbury. But it's really crucial for our family because when my little brother was 6 months, my mom was still nursing. She had to go away for 24 months. That impacts 11 years later, still lives with us deeply. It still lives the trauma of incarceration, still cycles, although we are abolitionists and we work on healing and exploring transformative justice and different ways to respond to harm that has been done to us or that we do to others. It still lives with us. And so we're just creating what different looks like. And I'm just a young girl in Roxbury just trying to really advocate and end incarceration of women and girls.
Thank you for that summary. I really appreciate it. Can you say a little bit of what incarceration for women and girls in Massachusetts looks like?
Yeah, so actually in Massachusetts, when I say I live in Roxbury, just to start it off, I live in Roxbury. Roxbury is in the center of the most incarcerated corridor. The most incarcerated corridor is from Nubian Square to Franklin Field. And that happens to be predominantly Black and brown. And then when we say incarceration of women and girls, Massachusetts has one of the smallest, lowest numbers of incarcerated women, a little bit under 600 women. Yet we have one of the highest numbers of women serving life. So it's really one way in and no way out. And also, you know, coming from a Black and brown community, as I mentioned earlier, coming from as a young woman growing up in a single woman household, over the last 10 years, there has been a 700% increase of women incarcerated. So what does that look like for Black and brown women? They are taking our mothers for decades. They have been already taking our fathers from us, even dating back to slavery. But now over the last 10 years, we have been stripped from our mothers. So now we're at the point of just like extending the cycle of incarceration and only continuing it and really not allowing families to heal and also have their mother, the backbone of our communities, because the system is taking these women from our community. So that's what incarceration looks like in Massachusetts for me.
Separating families, children from their mothers and fathers has been a history that goes way back in this country. And it's been a strategy, a deliberate strategy around making sure we can kind of weaken the bonds that families create. Can you say a little bit how that affected you, how you see others being affected?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's pretty much, I mean, everybody needs their mom and everybody needs their dad. And there's no system that can replace the bond of having a mother and a bond of having a father. So when you have a system that is creating a vision, even for our children, that says that your father is a monster or your mother is a monster just because they made a mistake, it already creates this visual for you as a child. So you already have this hate in have this hate within yourself. And as a daughter, which also will eventually kind of like drive you to become a monster because you feel like you don't have any outcome yet. Your only outcome is incarceration because your dad has been incarcerated. Your mother has been incarcerated. So that just means that that's your next step, which is incarceration. And that was something that was heavily for me when my mom, I was much older. I was in college when my mom was incarcerated. But one of the things that I can always remember and I always stand on is that I was very, because my dad had did such a long time, I was already I was insensitive to the situation. So I was like, okay, well, this is your time to be incarcerated. And then my time will be coming. But this is just something that my community members eventually have to go through in life. And that's wrong. That's just a sign of oppression that the system has, a cloud that the system has put over Black and brown communities or cash poor communities. And so I appreciate Family Suggested as Healing and the infrastructure that we're really creating in the communities, because we're really breaking a part of that cycle and really saying that our community does not have to end up incarceration. Incarceration was only there to destroy us as an alternative from slavery, and also just doing that education. And so that's how it impacted me. And I know that now I'm a mom of a 3-year-old who I'm sure y'all can hear making noise in the background. But, you know, my goal is to say that she will never be in prison. My little sister will never be in prison. My little niece will never be in prison. And all the girls that I mentor, they're never going to end up incarcerated or understand what it's like to be on a prison bunk, because they're much bigger than that. And the system, even down to the education system, the public education system that we have, it does not teach our children that they're bigger than what they are. And so that is where I'm at.
Well, no, I mean, it's incredibly important for us to highlight that so people understand what the impact of all of this is. And we, in that, you raised it into just to highlight even further the fact that the system of incarceration is in large part based on the supremacy of a white culture that first, in a sense, monetized Black bodies through slavery to raise significant capital on free labor. So cotton, textiles, and broad spectrums from sugar to all kinds of other products, we subsisted on, and we've become the most powerful nation in large part of that kickstart of having free labor for a consistent amount of time. And even past that time, we continued to incarcerate people with Jim Crow, slavery by another name, and doing prison loans in which we were getting free or low wage labor in all kinds of different ways. To this day, the Massachusetts state government mandates that all of our state agencies use the printers that are done in prisons across the Commonwealth. And so we're getting cheap printing services because of those incarcerated. And therefore, there's a conflict of interest on the way that we do that. Can you say a little bit about the inner workings of Families for Justice and Healing, the campaigns that it does, and why you've built the name Build Up People, Not Prisons?
Again, I love Families for Justice Healing and the National Council. It kind of like, it warms my heart every time I think of an organization like ours, because we really put the people first. And that's what it means when you say build up people, not prisons, mm-hmm. because it's an abolitionist organization. I mean, there's no reason why we're building up prisons and we're not really investing in the people that we're keeping trapped inside of these prisons, especially if we're trying to become progressive. Families for Justice Healing, we operate under three modules. And so what that looks like is policy work, which right now we're leading in Massachusetts is the prison and jail moratorium bill. We're actually having an event on February 14th to deliver letters of support for the judiciary because this bill has gotten into the judiciary. And so we're hoping that the judiciary votes favorably. The prison and jail moratorium bill is actually a direct reaction to Massachusetts trying to move forward with building a $50 million new women's prison that we strongly oppose because our numbers have increased dramatically. I believe in 2019 we were at about 1,000 women incarcerated, and now we're under 600 women. So, and we can all of us, me and you, on this call right now, could definitely create an exit plan for 600 women that don't include incarceration, but actually includes building up the people, and again, not a prison. But then we have a rack of policies, which is sex and drug decrim, medical and elderly parole. We have the primary caretakers, and also shout out to the Nurses Union for helping us really pass primary caretakers and also in shackling of incarcerated women. Because yes, they were incarcerating women when they were giving birth in active labor, and shame on Massachusetts or shame on anybody for thinking that a woman should be shackled while they're giving birth. Especially coming from a mother that gave birth, I didn't even want to be inside of a building, let alone shackled to a bed. But anyway, and then we operate under a hyper-local organizing, which we call the model of reimagining communities. Reimagining communities is a direct pushback to reimagining prisons because there is a narrative that's going around, even as we're trying to build new women's prisons or new prisons period, they're saying that prisons can be trauma-informed. And unless you have spent time inside of a prison or have been a child that has visited a prison every day or every week to visit your parents, or if you just had any interaction, you will understand that there is no such thing as a trauma-informed prison, and the culture in prison cannot be covered, whether you paint a wall pink, paint a wall blue, put beautiful pictures or murals. There is no such thing as a trauma-informed prison. I know right now there is HDR is leading the design and construction for Massachusetts' new women's prison that they're trying to build, which we will stop because we're going to get the prison and jail moratorium bill passed. But they, during their presentation, they mentioned that they were going to put a nursery inside of the prison and allow women to have their babies for up to a year inside of a prison. And so I always like to just cover, if we feel confident enough to give a woman a baby, does she really need to be inside of a prison? And so I just like to let that sit there because, they say prison is for the most angriest of angry people. And then everybody automatically goes to what does violent and nonviolent look like? But why would we ever give a woman a child and keep her inside of a cage if we felt inconfident, if we didn't have any confidence in her? But moving along, reimagining communities is really building up the people in the communities. We have carved out 22 blocks in Roxbury, which is our pilot project. And we investing in that community. We started a mutual aid project where we gave five women in that 22 radius $500 a month. We do participatory defense every week. We are now moving to doing participatory defense twice a week because it's just grown. Before the pandemic, it was a standing room only. And now we're doing Zoom up participatory defense and just trying to migrate back into the office slowly. We also just purchased a hydroponic farm, which the land is being surveyed and trees have to be cut down and electricity has to be installed to get the hydroponic farm operating. But that will be landing within the next 30 days. And more importantly, we have a mobile office. And the mobile office is eventually going to act as a crisis response team. So that way, and also resources, and also, you know, if we need to have I know we have some members that like to teach music, do cooking classes. We have lawyers that are going to help with record sealing, pardons, and expungement. So there's just going to be a lot of resources. But more importantly, we're going to have a 24-hour crisis response team. So when people are having mental health breakdowns or substance use issues or maybe domestic violence, we'll have community members that are trained with transformative justice and given the tools that they need so that way they can respond to the community. And the most beautiful thing about this is that you actually have community members that are in that block radius that are trained. So you know the people that are responding to you. So you can respond to them in a better manner. Sometimes, and I have experience with this, but sometimes when people call police, we all know police cause further harm. You end up with a record. And most of the time, by the time the police arrive, the situation is over and somebody just going to jail. But no, the police is never really needed in most cases. And for me, it's been all the cases. But with the community response team, there won't be a record. There won't be police being called. There won't be an interruption. It'll just be a diversion to a better pathway. And so that's with the crisis response team. We also do, we have our annual Christmas parties. We do newsletters. I'm actually going into the event, into the community today to give out flyers because on Saturday we're having a little Super Bowl event. But we just do fun things and we educate, we politicize, and we know as a community member, the strongest foundation of reimagining communities is the side of participatory defense, people's budget, the people's assembly process, transformative justice. Besides all of those dope components that go into reimagining communities, the foundation is really getting our community educated and understanding that we're in an oppression. So when we're out here screaming that we're going to end incarceration of women and girls, we're providing the tools to our community members so that way they never end up incarcerated in the first place. And that's how we're going to empty out those prisons and jails, right? If we just give our people the tools that they need. Last but not least, we have the Free Her campaign, which is part of our national organizing, which is the National Council for Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. And one of the beautiful parts about that is like we're literally about 4 weeks into our fellowship. We are really centered on the New England states, where because the New England states have one of the lowest numbers of incarcerated women. In Vermont, we have about 70 women incarcerated. So we're literally 70 women. In between us, there's 70 women to end in incarceration of women and girls. And my 3-year-old daughter can come up with an exit plan for each of those women. We can really do this in Vermont. We can do this anywhere. And so we're trying to use this as a grounding and a way to plan out flags. Basically say, this is what different looks like. This is what it means to end incarceration of women and girls. And this is how we move forward with life. So we have our fellowship. There are about five fellows altogether. There's 30 fellows, but there are about five in each of the states. And we're really training them. We put them through a 3-month training and then a project portion of it. So it's really amazing. And then also we launched through the national organization, we were able to move from five women getting basic income guarantee. So now we have 22 women getting a basic income guarantee. Four of those women are currently incarcerated. So there is many components that go into the Free Her campaign. We are directly in relationship with trying to end. Last January, we planted our flag on the first 100 days, to Biden to grant clemency to the first 100 women for the first 100 days, which fits our clemency campaign, which is releasing women that are elderly, survived and punished, women who have been incarcerated for 10 years or longer, or women who are sick and or living with a terminal illness. And I would like to say that in Massachusetts, there's a woman right now in Framingham who has dementia, who doesn't even know why she's incarcerated. When we talk about elderly women, women are aging rapidly inside of prisons because of the conditions of the prisons. And I always have to go back, because when we talk about the prison and jail moratorium bill, I know everybody's like, well, wouldn't you want a new prison because women want to live in a better place? But if you're only given that option, you're saying, do you want a new prison or do you want to stay in this prison? Of course, a woman that's incarcerated is going to say, I want a new prison, because that prison has been horrible. But if you give a woman an option and say, hey, do you want to start over at life? Do you want to go live with your family, or do you want to stay in this prison? That woman is going to say that she wants to be with her family. And also, DOC in Massachusetts has allowed these women for decades to live in these conditions. So why would they care about them now in 2022? And I know I'm going to stop here so we can move to the next question. But I recently, we've been doing a lot of campus organizing with colleges, and that's how I met you. And so we've been doing a lot of college organizing. But Wellesley College, which is a women's college, Wellesley's College and Framingham were both built in the same year. And so Wellesley is like on their 50th renovation. They're actually being renovated right now. Yet there has been no renovations for Framingham since they've been built. So we can literally see how the well-being of the women in Framingham is put first when it comes to DOC or Massachusetts as a whole.
Sashi, you covered a lot of territory in a very short period of time. I'm telling you, we have to get you to come over to the Back to School of Public Health to do some training for our professors. We could have our 3-hour classes cut to an hour and a half if they just did your way of providing a lecture and teaching information in all kinds of ways. You are a powerful speaker and you are a powerfully fast speaker. We covered a lot of ground, sister. It really is amazing. Let me ask you to go back to one of the things you spoke about in terms of the people's budget. Can you explain that in a little bit more detail and what that's about and why you think it's important?
Yeah, well, of course. So first shout out to FJA, Mass Power, because over the summer, we passed yes on question one, which is we were able to get a people's office inside of the state house, which now the people will have a voice for the budget, for the state budget. And so it's important because a lot of times, first of all, as a whole, police officers, like I said, we have one of the lowest numbers of women incarcerated, yet police officers' salaries are skyrocket. They have increased by like 25% over the last year. And so, and then also, you know, legislators are not really being transparent about where funding is going, or they're just not presenting this information to the people in the community. And as the people in the community who pay their taxes, we have a right to say, you know, instead of building up a new prison, so instead of increasing the salary for police officers or fixing unnecessary things, why don't we start to invest in the things that the people want? Mm-hmm. And so that's a part of the People's Assembly process as well, is when we have legislators, the legislators need to come back to the community and talk to the community and say, okay, what do you want this budget to look like? What kind of funding do you need as a community? What would make your community better? And what does public safety look like for you as far as on a budget scale, right? And so that's what the people's budget is about. And it's also, it goes hand in hand with the People's Assembly process, because the legislators have to work directly with the people and the budget has to reflect exactly what the people want.
And it's important for the audience to know the Family for Justice's Healing is a powerful website. If you go there, you look up the people's budget, and it has a great infographic that gives all the details and helps you clearly understand where the value in what Sashi is speaking about. Can you say a little bit about how as you've connected with women who have previously been incarcerated along the strip of where more incarcerated women in Massachusetts are incarcerated. How did you develop the kind of community organization in engaging those previously incarcerated women and others to be allies in this work? How did you go about creating that coalition?
Well, I always like to say, coming from a community of oppression, coming from a community where I have a criminal record, we're the first people to be overlooked and underheard and never heard. And so when you meet women who are able to identify that they're formerly incarcerated, you create a sisterhood. And also when you're inside of those prisons, my mom was incarcerated for 24 months, but her sisters that she's been incarcerated with that are now home, they don't go to sleep without saying goodnight to each other. They love upon each other. They're all family, and they also hurt every day because they still have sisters and family and mothers and prison moms and prison, daughters that are still incarcerated that they know should be home and that they know should never be incarcerated in the first place. So when you have that experience, that's how you create a partnership or a womanhood or a sisterhood, because y'all all share the same experiences. And also, we had a listening tour. We launched a listening tour that was about 2.5 years long, but we interviewed women and we put a call out, because sometimes women are not, especially in our community, they aren't able to be transparent to say that, yes, I was impacted by incarceration. And this is how I was impacted by incarceration, whether I'm formally incarcerated or I'm directly impacted. To give that space. And so that's how the sisterhood works, as far as building up the leadership and, connecting with women that are formerly incarcerated. And plus, we don't lose our connection to our sisters inside. We send newsletters inside, and that's why grandma is important. We send newsletters to the federal level and on the state level. Our mutual aid, we're giving four women that are currently incarcerated mutual aid, which is $500, which is a part of the basic income guarantee program. But there's a slogan that we use that says, "There is nothing about us without us." And we live with that. We walk with that every single day.
Do you want to introduce your daughter to the group, just so they know that you're a single mom and you're also while you're doing this podcast? Say your daughter's name again.
My daughter's name is Katori, and she loves cleaning. So she's like using water on the floor. So y'all see me grabbing like soda and stuff.
She's doing really well in the midst of this interview. I appreciate you, girl. So say a little bit more about that sisterhood. How does, I have family in prison, and I have had family members die in prison, and the people don't understand how invisible those that are incarcerated, those that have been over-policed and underrepresented in all kinds of different ways, the kind of invisibility of who they are and the kind of stigma, the thing that people believe that anybody in prison deserves to be in prison. We recognize more than ever that that is not always true. More than not, the over-incarceration of Black and Brown people over other people across the world, and in particular in the United States, really is uniquely different and speaks to the injustice that has been part of our country for a long time. The kind of loneliness in prison, how do we hold the humanity of people while they're there, fight for those and their rights to be sure that they're represented as effectively as possible, and then bring that story to publics in ways that they understand that this is a flawed system that can throw a human life away behind bars, as opposed to considering other alternatives, is a significant challenge. Just from hearing you hear what I say, and you saying your own experience as well as that of your family members, is there anything you can say out loud to kind of help people that just don't understand, for any number of reasons, how they might understand differently? So we in this country incarcerate more people than the rest of the world. we have done that for a significant amount of the time, and the numbers, you know, aren't changing significantly in any way. We have, with ease, just locked people away as if they don't exist anymore. We've taken away their humanity. We've taken away their rights. We've over-policed in a way that puts people in prison more than others that are doing harm in other communities are not being seen and heard or taken into account. You speak about the kind of the not being seen, people leaving, not even to a degree, ignoring the population, the significant population, particularly those of color, in prisons, and just believe that they don't matter. Why should they care about them? That's the question. That people would say they did something wrong. They're getting their due. Why should I care?
Yeah, and you know, one of the most important things with that is really like our language and learning how to humanize people again, because the system is creating a culture of dehumanizing people. And that's one of the ways they do that is using language like inmate. Like learning how to not call a person an inmate, but yet an incarcerated individual or an incarcerated person, or just acknowledging them as a person, period, which it goes a long way. But more importantly, you know, I feel like this is something that we do, that we struggle with for a very long time through our clemency campaign. It's when we're advocating for women, because we don't focus on nonviolent versus violent, because we understand that the state of incarceration is not getting to the root issue of why people are causing transgressions or having transgressions, right? It never gets to the root issue of why we can stop that, or how do we stop that, or where did we go wrong? Like, where did we fail this individual as a community, or as a mother, or as a daughter, or as a sister, whatever. Where do we feel this person, so that way we never see it happen again? And this is what the system does not do. And this is why we're never going to get to a state, if we continue to follow the system that we have, we're never going to get to a state of ending incarceration of people, period, because we're not getting to the root issue of the problem. And so us as individuals, we need to walk without passing judgment. We need to understand that things happen. People cause harm to other people, and harm is going to be done to you, but how do we respond to it? And how do we acknowledge the harm that is being done to others and it is done to us? And I feel as though we have never been given that, coming from a Black and Brown community, coming from a single head household, we have never been taught that. We've never been taught how to respond to harm. We've only just internalized it or passed judgment. And so, and this is what got us to the culture of incarceration, because we're just like punishing people without really understanding why we're punishing them. And so that's what I feel. And that's why I think transformative justice is important. And I also feel as though, as an abolitionist, you know, we're working through these things every day. We're working through, what does it look like for communities to hold people accountable to their transgressions? And we work through that. And as an abolitionist and as an abolitionist organization, we don't think that like everybody should just, you know, go live their best life, go cause harm to people, and nothing should be done. We have to get to the ground of accountability. And we have to understand when we're, you know, I like to, as I'm a new mom, and I apologize that my daughter's screaming.
No need to apologize.
As I'm a new mom, it really opened me up to humanity, right? And so when I look at people that are even older than me, I think that, and they may have caused harm to people. And this was really, this really grounded me when I was leading the clemency campaign, because there were women that may have caused harm to, you know, severe harm to others. But like, what really grounded me was the fact that people are not just born angry, right? People have had to go through cycles of life to get to where they are, to end up inside of that prison. And if we had a diversion, or if we had resources in our community that can really get people to another pathway, we wouldn't have to figure out why people are sitting on a prison bunk because of what they did. We would have, so the person probably would have been able to cure COVID by now, because we would have given the proper diversion. And so I always go back to our infrastructure of reimagining communities, because that's why reimagining communities is so important, because we have to give the community members that are under-resourced and over-incarcerated the tools that they need so that way they never end up incarcerated in the first place. And that when we walk through the door, people see us as human beings. When I start to talk about the work that we're doing in the community and how it's important, as I use my platform, my only goal in life is to, at one point I was also on a pathway of destruction, because I thought that eventually my turn would be inside of a prison. But then when I became politicized, more so when my mom came out and hit the ground running and saying, hey, like, this system is like, what's going on here? And she really helped us read books. She educated us a lot. She talked to us, and we really rerouted our family into what different looks like and how we can really get under the cloud of oppression. But being that I had that experience and I had that opportunity, my goal is to give every young woman that I have any interaction with the same same opportunity that I had. You know, I have these conversations, even if people don't want to listen to it, I'm still like, well, you deserve better. You want to start a business, you start that business. You want to go to school, you go to school. And these are things that people do not tell our children in the community. Yet when they see us, they don't even want to view us as human beings. So if we were never viewed as a human before we went into prison, we're never going to be viewed as a human when we're in prison. And then when we get out of prison, we're still not viewed as a human. Yet they want us to do the right thing. Right. And what is the right thing? And so as individuals, I really think that we follow a letter by Eddie Ellis, and he teaches us about language. He's a late author. He was formerly incarcerated. He's our dear Conrad. But we follow his letter, and I can share the link with you in the letter. But it teaches us about even down to talking about substance use, learning language for, instead of calling people harmful words, you say, okay, you use substances, or you're dealing with mental health, you know, and it just broadens your vocabulary and it doesn't cause further harm. We don't realize that the words that we use to people only cause further harm, and it really dehumanizes people as an individual. And that's what the system wants us to do to each other, whether we're incarcerated or we're not incarcerated. They want us to think that we're gangs, like we're in a gang. Where, you know, when we talk about humble, it's H block, you know, it's not H block, it's humble Ave, right? And I've lived off humble Ave for a long time, but like, we have to get away from those labels.
There couldn't have been a better answer, Sashi. I really appreciate it. Apologize for if that question wasn't clear, but it is important to kind of summarize this. So you've spoke about how for decades, centuries, people have been marginalized, disempowered, and slowly but surely dehumanized in all kinds of different ways, while at the same time they're being over-policed, over-incarcerated, underrepresented, and to a sense, erased and just locked away in a way so that people don't understand who they are. And it's in that disempowerment, in that marginalization, in that discrimination, in that kind of body control and all kinds of other ways. Then on top of that, over-policing and then incarcerating and continuing to dehumanize by giving them a number, taking their name away, controlling who visits and how often they visit, making them pay for calls to get to speak to anybody. If they're on parole or need to get out, they have to pay for all of those services. So they're in this loop that they can't get out of the hole that they get dug into. All of those things, you wonder why people will lash out, why they can be angry, while they there's very little people that don't go right back in, because there really isn't support for kind of re-education, finding ways to reform. Is supposed to be prison reform, but for the most part, people are just locked away and forgot about, harmed in all kinds of violent ways in a place that, as you say so correctly, there's no way for it to be a trauma before informed. People come out so traumatized, so broken in so many different ways. It's a wonder that they can continue to persist, and they do persist at the same time. You know, more communities, Black and Brown, have persisted over and over again. We can't lose sight of that. So I'm grateful for that answer. People can hear that it is that dehumanizing that allows us to think that it's fine, okay, normal to put someone in not just behind bars, but to put many in solitary confinement that can break not only their body, their mind in all kinds of ways. And the idea that we take people and do that, take them away from their family and take children, their parents, their mothers and fathers away from them is unconscionable in my view. And I think finding ways to understand that better, to incarcerate people as your organization speaks to, is critical. Can you say a little more about how you call yourself and Family for Justice is Healing calls itself an abolitionist organization?
Yeah, and also, you know, before we go into that, I do want to let allies know that allies that are listening. I know that, like, I remember one day I was working in Newton, and I used to be a waitress for years when I was in college. But I remember I was just having a regular basic conversation about incarceration. And, you know, the family members, they said they were like, oh, we never had any impact. Like they never even had a family member that was incarcerated. And so, you know, they're here they are as like a wife and a husband eating dinner with their two children, you know, together as a family, as a unit, never had any impact with incarceration, no impact with the law, nothing. And, you know, and it's so easy for a person like that to pass judgment on people like us who have been impacted by incarceration, because our communities are two very different communities, you know? And so what that looks like is that instead of passing judgment, you have to figure out how you can support, and allies have to play a role at listening. And listening to the people. And really, you know, when I was we did a 90-mile walk in support of the prison and jail moratorium bill. And I was always, I've been at all since, because I've never seen a gun shop. And because I live in Dorchester and Roxbury. And so, you know, walking through those communities that were like, I forgot even what they were called. It was like Wade Woodbury, you know, it was in different parts of Massachusetts. But I happened to walk past a gun shop, and I didn't even know it was a gun shop. I thought it was a corner store. And I walked in it, and I was like, oh, wow, there's shotguns and stuff. And I, you know, it was just such a different experience, you know, because they would have never allowed that to be in Roxbury or Dorchester, but they allowed it to be in a community that is predominantly white. And that alone just shows the difference that they, the culture of how they feel about us versus how they don't feel about us, you know, and just like the different experiences that people have, because Black people have the right to go hunting, right? Some of us like to go hunting. And so we should have that option or that alternative. And another thing is that I know in the Boston Globe, there was an article, and the media plays a role in this, because the media is always targeting the things that we do wrong in the community. Yeah, I don't see the media covering that we just purchased a hydroponic farm and we're giving out free vegetables, or that we have a mobile office that's responding to crisis in our community. Where's the media to cover that? But the media wants to cover, you know, our young boys riding the dirt bikes up and down Blue Hill Live. And we have a solution for that. If our young boys want to ride dirt bikes, why don't we create a park where they can safely ride dirt bikes instead of criminalizing them, and which is going to cause further harm? And so I just wanted to just point out that as far as like for allies, just so that way we can see the differences of the resources and reactions that happen to people in Roxbury and Dorchester that are over incarcerated versus if you live in Newton or, you know, Natick, or, you know, those other surrounding areas that surround the most incarcerated corridor. I just think it's important to uplift that we don't have any resources. It should never be that people should pass judgments on the transgressions that happen in our communities, because sometimes we just need a second chance or a first chance, right? We need an alternative. But families for justice. Well,
let me just say, I have to ask, do you also have a license as a minister? Because you just took it to church just a minute ago, and you couldn't have said it better. I'm telling you, you could preach. So yes, my question was how you Can you say more about how you and your organization call yourself an abolitionist and an abolitionist organization?
I think it speaks for itself. Families first. Families for justice, healing. I think that everything that we do, like I said, is nothing about us without us. We building up people, not prisons. We put the people first. Everything that we do moves from a people's perspective. And even when we're doing our presentations, when we're having conversations, when we're doing movement, we are moving with the people first. It's not a system. It's not legislation. It's not prisons. It's not any of that. It's the people. What would make the people better? What would make our generations better? How do we stop harm from happening to our young children? How do we stop harm from our children to stop causing harm to other people or our adults? Like, where do we find healing in our community? And so I think that's what makes us an abolitionist organization. We don't, if my mom ever listens to this podcast or if she was hearing me now, she'd be very proud because, you know, one of her favorite slogans is that for many years, for decades, for her over 10 years of her organizing, the mission of the organization has always been to end incarceration of women and girls. There's no reform in that. There's no reforming and ending incarceration of women and girls. Ending incarceration of women and girls means dismantling the system, bringing it down. And then also when you talk about ending incarceration of women and girls, we mean shutting prisons down, but we also mean providing resources to those women that were incarcerated or that are incarcerated.
Well, they don't have to go back there.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing you say is that it is about being an abolitionist, it means abolishing prisons, making it so that we don't have to put people in prison. We have alternatives. We have abolition police, where they're committed to abolishing prisons and imprisonment and finding alternative ways of doing it. I see on the website it's abolishing juries and abolitionist courts, where they're working to make sure we're not putting people in prisons. We don't need to build any new prisons. We can tear them down, but we build people up in the midst of all of that by making sure they have opportunity to have a good job, live in a good home, have access to food, be able to make sure their children can get good educations and be all of who they can be. That's about putting the people first and finding ways to stop dehumanizing and rehumanize in all kinds of ways to make sure that people can be seen and heard and understood and valued in the way that we deserve to be.
So we don't need community police, but more so we're trying to say community members. Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm. for example, mm-hmm. we just want to get away from all of that, all the system. We want to get away from the police. We want to get away from the courts. We want to get away from everything that had to do with the system. And that's why we have to dismantle everything and just rebuild a new structure that really works for the people. And even, you know, when we talk about the courts, you know, laws are ancient, right? And so if we're not, you know, if a person is stealing candy from the candy store and it carries a mandatory minimum, we know stealing candy from the candy store is really, you know, a petty and to just, do you need candy? Do you need $5 a month so that way you can buy candy? Like, that's how that could be resolved. Yet, you know, laws are carrying mandatory minimums for things that can be easily resolved. And it's causing people to sit inside of a prison. And, you know, what I don't think that people are getting is that when, you know, we have children and we have, and this is why moms are important. And this is why, you know, supporting women and girls is so important in the community, because women are the backbone of the community. So when we have, you know, men just sitting, our loved ones, or we're also losing income from households when we're incarcerating parents. And so how do we provide funding for those people when that parent is now a single household and then not expect for more, you know, more spirals down the rabbit hole? Is that what it calls? Not for you. Now you're just sending me down the rabbit hole when you're taking incomes and all of this stuff away. So this is what putting people first means. And Families for Justice That's Healing does that. All of our bills are abolitionist bills. We push for abolitionist bills. We push for putting the people first. I'm really excited because we're about to have a pantry. So if folks wanted to donate also canned goods and like food or baby clothes or, you know, a gently used brand new, hopefully, But we have a pantry, and so people can come and go shopping and not feel like we're giving stuff away and feel like they're just accepting like donations because they're not worthy enough. But instead, you get, here's a shopping bag, and you can go into the pantry and go shopping, and then you check out at the end. Like, well, this is nice. I hope you enjoy your day. But you get that experience of feeling like you are a human. You're a person. Like, we all need help at some point in our life, and that's what Families for Justice and Healing does. There's people that come to us for mutual aid support, for housing support, and this is, and we have a micro budget compared to the state moving forward with $50 million to build a new women's prison. Imagine if we had $50 million, how many lives we could save. I mean, we're saving lives with our micro budget now. I mean, that's what putting the people first means. Amen. And also, you know, Massachusetts has a plan. In addition to our prison and jail moratorium bill, Massachusetts has a plan to spend $520 million over the next 10 years on prisons and jails. And so as we're going to get this moratorium bill passed, we're saying that we need to pledge half of that money that was going to go into prisons and jails, and we need to pledge it to the people. Right? Like, what does new parks in communities that don't have parks look like? What does giving more food to people that don't have food? We should have hundreds of food pantries in communities that don't have resources, so that way people can go to the refrigerator and get canned goods. I mean, we were already struggling before the pandemic, and we're struggling 10 times harder after the pandemic. And the pandemic has also showed us that, you know, I remember walking into Stop and Shop in the beginning of the pandemic, and one of the, and I always, some, I don't know if it's like God's way, but every time somebody gets caught stealing groceries, I'm like, well, I'll just pay for the shopping cart of groceries. So I'm like hoping one day somebody just walks past me and says, I'll pay for your groceries maybe one day. But through the pandemic, it showed that instead of incarcerating people for stealing groceries, they literally walked up to them and said, you got caught, put the groceries back and leave the store. That ended that. There wasn't no summons to court. There wasn't anybody going to prison. And these are just minor steps that we can take that will literally decarcerate Massachusetts and put the people first.
No, it is so clear. And I so appreciate you started by talking about your pantry. As we wrap up, can you say a little bit about how listeners that might be interested in helping Families for Justice and Healing, building up People Not Prisons, how can they help your organization?
Well, you can check out our website. We have a lot of actions right now. We're specifically focused. One, you can donate. That's the first thing, right? Mm-hmm. You can always donate. But our membership is, our volunteer base is super important for us. So if you're an ally and you want to organize, you want to become a part of our Building Up People in Our Prisons Coalition, you can check out our website. You can email me personally. We do trainings for folks, so that way we're all on the same abolitionist spectrum. That's one way. You can promote our work. You can spread the word that, hey, we support ending incarceration of women and girls. And then also, as we're pushing for the prison and jail moratorium bill, we have a lot of phone calls that you can call. You can call Michael Day to start and tell him that you support the prison and jail moratorium bill. And these are just small steps, but if you reach out to our website, we can definitely point you in all the directions that you need to go for support, because we can use all of the support. And also doing presentations. Like, if you're a doctor and you want us to do a presentation, we need the doctors behind us. If you're a lawyer, we need lawyers behind us. If you're a scientist, we need scientists behind us. We need everybody to say, listen, we understand and we support ending incarceration of women and girls, and they have our support. So what can we do to help them get closer to their goal?
Sashi, thank you so much for your time. All that information, people hear that, I'm pointing them to your website, familiesforjusticeishealing.org, right?
Yeah.
Yes. And I'd love to bring you back to the School of Public Health for a training, because I think some students and faculty and staff would love that training. And I so appreciate you. I appreciate your voice. I know some of your other colleagues at your organization, and I'm sending love towards all of you all. And I will look forward to seeing you on campus sometime soon, and we'll follow up to reach out to you all. Thank you for this conversation, and thank you for all you do for our community. I can't be more grateful and appreciative of the work of you and your organization. I wish you all the best, and the best to your daughter.
Thank you. And before I leave, I also wanted to say, this is what colleges are for also. If there's a college in Massachusetts, we should be really figuring out how we can give community members that are struggling a free ride to colleges that are right in our backyard. Massachusetts has the strongest education base, and there's no reason why our people are struggling to get education because we can't afford it. And if we're a Massachusetts resident or a Roxbury resident or Dorchester, we should be figuring out how we can give scholarships to these people so that way they can get an education as well. And so thank you for having me, and I look forward to any other relationships that we build. And
well, Reverend Sashi, amen to you and amen to your last words. I appreciate everything that you said and everything you are. And I'll let you know when this comes out so that you can share it with others so that more people can hear about the work that all of you and your organization do. I wish you all the best.